This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
And the way to solve these problems for me is through discussion, negotiation, changing policies, etc. And I'm afraid that if we go into this kind of blacklisting, etc., we will be cut from the possibility to organize some kind of negotiations.
That's Yusuf Adam, a history professor at the University of Eduardo Mondlane in Maputo, who disagrees with the U.S. declaration that insurgents in northern Mozambique are a terrorist group. Details coming up also. Talks to resolve the dispute between Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia over the Grand Renaissance Dam has failed to make progress. And today marks the 27th commemoration of the Hutu genocide against Tutsis in 1994. All these and more ahead on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. The Southern African Development Community is under pressure to find an urgent solution to the deteriorating security situation in Mozambique. An armed militant group believed to be linked to Islamic State has killed many people and sent thousands fleeing their homes in Cabo Delgado province, sparking concerns that the unrest could spread to Mozambique's neighbors. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The worst attack by the insurgents came a week ago when militants armed with guns and machetes invaded the northern town of Palma, killing dozens. Survivors say the militants swept across the town, randomly shooting at anyone in sight and touching homes, the town administration offices, and a health facility. Residents fled to the nearby bushes, where some spent up to 7 days without food and water. When they returned, they found a ghost town of burned buildings and some streets littered with bodies of those who were not so lucky to escape. Piers Pigot is a senior consultant for Southern Africa at the International Crisis Group.
The insurgency really did escalate during the course of the last 15 months. Just in terms of IDPs, internally displaced people, we've seen an increase of over 500,000 in the last 12 months. The number of attacks have escalated rapidly. I think regional analysts have been clear for some time that there is a huge problem.
Many have been evacuated by boats, but thousands are either dead or still on the run, facing hunger, thirst, and exhaustion. Ada Zabalgogiaska is with the Doctors Without Borders team in Mozambique.
We are very worried that probably the most vulnerable and the most sick and the people who has been seriously wounded, they are not reaching our facilities. They are telling us that basically they left in groups of 20 or 40 people, and now half of the group is left behind because they couldn't keep the pace. We are probably talking about women, about elders, about people who has wounds, etc.
The situation is being felt by neighboring countries. One South African was killed and dozens have been repatriated back home. President Cyril Ramaphosa says his government is concerned.
We have already attended to the issue of evacuating those South Africans who are stranded in Mozambique, and already one of those who passed away, the South African National Defense Force has brought them back, and we remain involved with securing the safety of our people in Mozambique.
Tanzania also faces a real threat since it shares a border with Mozambique. Many have accused the SADC of failing to take strong action against the militants who started their attacks in 2017. The SADC organ responsible for politics, defense, and security says it will hold an urgent meeting tomorrow to discuss the deteriorating security situation in Mozambique. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Also, in a related story, some analysts worry that a recent declaration by the U.S. government could be counterproductive to ending an insurgency in northern Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province. Washington recently designated the militants who say they're allied to Islamic State as a foreign terrorist organization, or FTO. In theory, this permits U.S. agencies to actively pursue them and their supporters by investigating, arresting, and prosecuting them, as well as seizing any of their assets on American soil. Darren Taylor has more.
Yusuf Adam, a history professor at the University of Eduardo Mondlane in Maputo, has been visiting Cabo Delgado since the uprising started in late 2017. The United Nations estimates about 2,000 people have been killed in violence since then, with 700,000 displaced. The militants, who also call themselves Al-Shabaab, claim to be fighting for the poor of Cabo Delgado, but they often treat them brutally, even murdering them. However, Adam sees Washington's FTO designation as unnecessary.
And the way to solve these problems for me is through discussion, negotiation, changing policies, etc. And I'm afraid that if we go into this kind of blacklisting, etc., we will be cut from the possibility to organize some kind of negotiations.
Other analysts are concerned that the terror designation will give the group impetus, allowing it to claim victimization by Washington, which could spawn an influx of recruits from across Africa who want to fight a jihad against America. Adam says it's in Maputo's interests to use the US's FTO designation to militarize the situation.
I don't believe in a military solution. And as soon as this declaration was done, some Mozambican leaders said, aha, now we are going to show these bandits in the bush what is going to happen to them.
In reality, argues Adam, what's happening in Cabo Delgado is not an invasion by foreign Islamic terrorists, as the Mozambican government wants the world to believe.
They kill young people, they cut their heads, which is true. They rape women, they take the girls from the villages, that's also very true. But at the same time, some people in the army violate human rights, but also international private companies.
He says the extremists are taking advantage of Maputo's decades of neglect and abuse of Cabo Delgado's people, who have watched the government, in partnership with multinationals, exploit the area's mineral wealth. They've extracted petroleum, natural gas, and the world's largest pink sapphire and ruby deposits. Adam says almost nothing's been done to improve the lives of locals. He does, however, believe that positive developments are happening because of the US's FTO designation. Adam says it's good that the US military, in the form of a few advisors, are now in Mozambique to train the army.
There has been a disinvestment in the army. And one needs an army which is capable. We have very good soldiers, we have very good men who have to be really trained, and an institution has to be built in the sense that it allows them to reply to the situation where we are.
It's obvious that the Mozambican security forces need training, he says, judging from what a soldier in Cabo Delgado told him recently.
We have problems because, you know, we belong to the army and the other guys who are operating in the area belong to FIR, which is the special forces of the police. So many times we shoot each other.
Adam says another good aspect of Washington's designation is that it's focused international humanitarian groups on Cabo Delgado. He hopes some of them can help enhance stability in the region with projects that create jobs in industries like agriculture and fishing. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The United Nations says the latest violence in West Darfur has prevented aid from reaching about 700,000 people in West Darfur who already were in vulnerable condition. Intercommunal violence between Arab militia and Masalit tribesmen broke out against an El Janina on Saturday and left at least 56 people dead. The UN is appealing for nearly $2 billion to help displaced people in Darfur and other parts of Sudan. Gunshots could still be heard in El Janina yesterday. The UN says the local power station in El Janina has been destroyed, causing a power blackout across the state. Markets remain closed, access to roads are blocked, and rocket-propelled grenades destroyed several hospitals. The World Health Organization reports that countries in sub-Saharan Africa are vulnerable to a potentially deadly third wave of COVID-19 as healthcare systems in many countries face funding shortages. Arigando gives us more on the story from Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe is among a number of countries that the World Health Organization WHO says are vulnerable to a potentially deadly third wave of COVID-19 that will be worsened by overburdened medical facilities. In a recent report, the World Health Organization said sub-Saharan Africa is likely to face a surge of new cases from COVID-19 variants in the next few weeks. The WHO says the region now has more than 3.1 million confirmed cases, with at least 110,000 deaths. That is up from 2.7 million infections recorded at the end of December. South Africa has the most cases, with 1.5 million reported patients and nearly half the continent's deaths. Dr. Obwogo Subiri is with Kenya's COVID-19 National Steering Committee.
There's definitely a surge in infections in Kenya. People are moving freely around. There's also a curfew starting at 8 o'clock. There's closure of bars, closure of hotels except takeaway, closure of places of worship, and also bars and restaurants. Generally, our test rates have been very, very low. And in most cases, we tend to test people at risk. In other words, those who present with symptoms. So I think it's very difficult to sort of look at it and say these are waves, but generally there is a surge in infections.
One new concern is a new variant of COVID-19 that was first identified in travelers from Tanzania. Neighboring Kenya is vulnerable to the variant because of its proximity to the East African nation. The WHO report says the pandemic has hit health personnel around the world hard, with 267 health worker infections being recorded daily. In several African countries, healthcare workers have threatened or taken labor actions because of a shortage of personal protective equipment, a lack of medical supplies, and overwork. Zimbabwe's COVID-19 National Task Force says it has stepped up strategies to thwart the spike in cases. Among its plans are a vaccination program and a proposed vaccine passport. The vaccination program aims to reach 60% of the population, or 10 million people. So far, more than 115,000 Zimbabweans have been vaccinated. The vaccination program aims to reach 60% of the population, or 10 million people. So far, more than 115,000 Zimbabweans have been vaccinated. In Zimbabwe, as in other countries, shortages of vaccines and of the supplies and equipment needed to give patients the shots has slowed vaccine efforts. There is also the aspect of vaccine skepticism. Healthcare experts say in many African countries, a lack of funds has hampered COVID-19 testing. So much of the continent's population is going untested. That could mean the current World Health Organization statistics undercount the number of people who have actually contracted the virus. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
The latest talks to resolve the dispute between Egypt, Sudan and Ethiopia over the controversial hydroelectric dam project on the Nile have ended without progress. An Associated Press report says officials from the three nations met under the leadership of the African Union in an effort to find agreement on an approach to resume the filling and operation of the dam reservoir. However, the four-day meeting concluded yesterday after Ethiopia rejected a Sudanese proposal backed by Egypt to include international mediators in the talks. Today, the international community joins Rwanda for the 27th commemoration of the Hutu genocide against the Tutsis in 1994. As Eugene Uwimana reports from Rwanda's capital, Kigali, many perpetrators and victims have worked to put hatred behind them.
Jean Damascene Renzaho chats with Donny Kamali, the man whose mother Renzaho killed. Renzaho sounds remorseful while reflecting on the events during the 1994 genocide against the Tutsis. Speaking in Kinyarwanda, Renzaho says he was 17 years old when he joined people armed with guns and machetes who stormed a home in the area where Rwanda Patriotic Army soldiers were suspected to be hiding. He says they didn't find any soldiers, but an elderly woman named Elokaldia Mukachibungo came out of the house. Renzaho says, "I killed her." After the Rwanda Patriotic Army managed to seize control, Renzaho fled to Kigali, fearing retribution from the people whose relatives he had helped kill. He finally turned himself in and served 10 years in prison. He was freed in 2004 and began to face genocide survivors. He says it was not easy meeting survivors. He was afraid and says he felt a lot of guilt and fear. Renzaho says he gathered the courage to visit Kamali's home, had killed his mother, and he told Kamali about the event during the genocide. Renzaho says he was surprised to be forgiven, and he felt relieved because the crimes used to haunt him. He says, "Now I feel like a free man." It was not easy for survivors to live with neighbors who once had hunted and killed their loved ones. But after the genocide, unity and reconciliation initiatives were strengthened. And a few years ago, when Renzaho was baptized in a church, Donny Kamali became his godfather. Kamali says it took him a long while to recover. He can't erase what happened from his memory, but says they have accepted that they will move along with the perpetrators for the sake of unity and reconciliation. Kamal says nursing a grudge would not lead him anywhere or resurrect his dead. Now he says they help each other in affirming and invite each other to ceremonies. Rwandan President Paul Kagame, who has led the country since the genocide ended, has said that unity and reconciliation are the only way the country can develop. Before they put down their weapons, the genocidas, who were from the Hutu ethnic group, had killed more than 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus. Today, at the genocide memorial in Kigali, a flame of remembrance has been lit and will burn for 100 days, the number of days of the killing. This year's theme is Remember, Unite and Renew. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Libya's elections should be held in a way to satisfy all political forces and Russia will facilitate it in every way possible. Russia also has been trying to win Libyan hearts and minds through vaccine politics. Former Austrian military attaché to Libya, Wolfgang Porstei, discussed moves in Libya by Russia and other foreign powers with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
As it did before Haftar's doomed offensive on Tripoli, Russia plays again both sides in the conflict. Prime Minister Dabeba has very good personal contacts to Russia as a businessman, and he will certainly exploit this also as a prime minister, which is, of course, very positive. But he was already warned by some powerful militias in Tripoli from getting too close to Moscow, as this is not in the interest of everyone in Libya. The Russians are currently working on winning hearts and minds, also by their corona vaccine diplomacy. Just last Sunday, the first corona vaccines arrived in Libya, in Tripoli, to be more precise, and those were 100,000 doses Sputnik V from Russia. While the Russians could live with remaining in Libya while sharing the influence with Turkey, the question is if the West, especially the United States, can live with a strong Russian position in Libya. I doubt it.
An Israeli newspaper said that Saddam Haftar, the son of General Haftar, met with some Israeli officials to gain their support for his bid to run as the next president of Libya, competing with Saif al-Islam Qaddafi. What are chances for such faces to lead Libya soon?
I'm pretty sure their chances are not too bright. Saddam Haftar is a controversial figure, although he's described by some as handsome and a more diplomatic person than his father. I would not bet that he would get even a majority of the votes in eastern Libya if he runs. Saif al-Islam is not only under US and UN sanctions, and he is subject to an arrest warrant by the International Criminal Court, he was also sentenced to death by a court in Tripoli. And I would be really surprised if he can run as long as this ruling stands. I would consider Saif as a polarizing person, certainly not able to unify the country. If I may, about the article in the Jerusalem Post. This one is based on a single source information. Hamas is smuggling weapons in cooperation with jihadists in Libya from Libya through Egypt into the Gaza Strip. Also, Egypt is worried about this. So I would not be surprised if Israel has some low-profile contacts with the Haftar side. And maybe the Israelis stated something about supporting Saddam during such a meeting, I would say, at least as a matter of politeness. I doubt that the Israelis are not aware of the dire prospects of Saddam Haftar to become president of Libya. And I don't think that Israeli support would do Saddam Haftar any good in Libya if he runs for presidency.
There are several movements to start reconstruction and restore services and counter the coronavirus in Libya. Would that introduce international cooperation or harsh competition?
It is still by far not sure that Libya's way towards stability will be without setbacks. Nevertheless, for the time being, it seems that the direction is the correct one. Therefore, it is understandable that the race for renewing old contracts and starting new ones has already started. My advice to these international companies is to be careful. They should follow the developments, the political, economic, and security developments in Libya very closely, assess them properly, and draw the right conclusions for them. While it is quite safe to invest in some parts of Libya, including the greater Misrata area, this cannot be said from other areas, especially in the far south. There will be certainly harsh competition between the various companies working in one sector, especially in the construction and oil business. And countries like Turkey, who were staunch supporters of the Misrata and the Tripoli side in the civil war, will have a clear starting advantage. As some recent contacts in Misrata and in Sabia, this is about the new harbor of the city, prove. One must be careful that this competition will not increase the already high, very high level of corruption in Libya. So my advice to the Dabeba government is to be transparent about any new contracts.
That was former Austrian military attaché to Libya, Wolfgang Porstei, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Botswana's hunting season opened Monday with nearly 300 elephant licenses on offer. The reserve price for each animal has been set around $15,000. But an auction is expected to increase the prices. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokandisi Dube has the details.
Elephants attract the highest price during Botswana's hunting season, with some licenses sold for 43,000 per animal at an auction last year. On Monday, the Department of Wildlife and National Parks issued a list of species to be hunted this season, which includes elephants, ostriches, buffaloes, and zebra. The reserve price to hunt an elephant is 150,000 pula, or $15,000, but the amount is expected to rise during a bidding process. The auction will take place on April 15. Then the hunts will begin. Some conservationists oppose elephant hunts, but professional hunters like Orendi Mutsumi are excited. He says professional hunters like him have been without a job since 2014 when Botswana imposed a hunting ban.
We are very, very happy to get our jobs back after a long time. I don't know when was the last time we get paid from this hunt, so it will be very grateful for us to start doing that. But we don't know if everything will go smoothly, because here are the lockdowns and everything. So we are still having a question mark on everything.
The government says hunters must be accompanied by game rangers and have the necessary permits. In 2019, an elephant wearing a collar for research purposes was gunned down by a licensed citizen in the country's northwest. This year, the hunting season takes place weeks after the International Union for Conservation of Nature, IUCN, listed African elephants as endangered. But Botswana says its numbers are growing and therefore not under threat. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habroni, Botswana.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Iheyes Uhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.